Hello, this is Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. On today's episode, San Luis Obispo County Library Director Brian Reynolds chats with local author and professional surfer Eric Soderquist and photographer Chris Bricard as they take you on an adventure of California surfing from the Oregon border to Tijuana. It's chronicled in their book, The California Surf Project. Also, Donna Cheek profiles two North San Luis Obispo County groups that improve the lives of cats and dogs, especially through spay and neuter programs. But first, there's a new federally mandated fishery management system on the West Coast called Catch Shares, and it's making both fishermen and environmentalists happy. Marisa Waddell talks with one of each about what Catch Shares mean to local fish and fishermen.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Today, we're talking about fish, sustainable fishing, to be precise, and how a new coming together of fishermen and environmentalists, the regulators and the regulated, is affecting an industry that's very important to our region and to the state. I'm talking about the West Coast Catch Shares Program. With me are some folks who know all about it, including Shems Judd of the Environmental Defense Fund and Rob Seitz, who is a lifelong fisherman working out of Morro Bay. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shems, would you please just give us a quick overview of what the Catch Shares program is in layman's terms?
So Catch Shares is basically a management tool where the total allowable catch, so the amount of fish that regulators determine can be removed from the ocean, is essentially divvied up between the fishermen who are permitted to fish for those fish. A classic kind of management system is known as open access, and that's a system where basically everyone races for the fish until all of the fish is gone. Under Catch Shares, the goal is really to do away with that derby-style fishery, that open access system, and give everyone a vested interest in the right to catch a certain amount of fish.
What was wrong with the way it was before, Rob?
Well, it was a lot more volume-oriented because we were competing with other fishermen, and you want your fair share, so you go out and catch them as fast as you can. And the problem is maybe the market doesn't need that many fish at the time, so you end up getting a lower price, or because you're trying to catch them fast, you catch large amounts of them, and so there's a lot of waste.
So you're actually throwing fish away the other way?
Prior management system was known as trip limit management, and so the year was divided into 6 2-month trip limits. And we're talking about ground fish here, so these are flatfish species like Dover and Petrolli sole, round fish like black cod, ling cod, and then rockfish species, quite a few different rockfish species. And for each 2-month trip limit, the Pacific Fishery Management Council, which governs fishing on the West Coast, would set an amount of each species that could come out of the water in those 2 months. But these species co-occur in the water, and so you can't really select exactly how much of each one you're going to pull up when you tow your net through. And so towards the end of the 2-month limit, for example, if Rob had his Dover limit or he had his sablefish limit, but he still had some Petrolli he needed to catch or some chili pepper or one of the other species, if he makes a tow to try to catch that species and fill out that limit, if he catches some Dover or sablefish or something that he already had his limit for, he was required by law to shovel that fish over the side. Mm. If he landed more fish than he was allowed, there were penalties involved. And so the prior management system actually created a tremendous amount of discards. And Catch Shares is a tool that really gets us away from that. If Rob catches too much now, if he catches more than his quota now, he can trade with another fisherman. The overall cap is still retained, but he can lease some fish or barter with another fisherman for the excess and continue fishing. So there's no waste. He doesn't have to throw the excess over the side.
So as an average person who consumes fish, why should I be interested in a Catch Shares program?
Sustainability is a popular word these days, and we'd like to see that the resource is there for my kids. I'd like them to have access to a healthy resource like I had.
Yeah, I think this waste issue is an important one. Under the previous management system, about 20 to 25% of the fish that was caught was wasted. It had to be thrown over the side. So that's needless waste of perfectly good local fresh seafood that could otherwise be landed. So I think that's unfortunate. Under the catch share system, it's about 3%. is wasted. So we're seeing dramatic reduction in discard. There's also several sensitive stocks of overfished and rebuilding rockfish populations, which means that their abundance is so low that the fishery managers had to set special limits for those species to try to rebuild them to a more viable population. Under the catch share system, fishermen actually have an economic incentive to try to avoid those species, to restore them to health.
Shems, you're the deputy regional director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Oceans Program. What does that mean in terms with working with fishermen on the catch shares program?
One of the really heartening things I think about this whole process is that it was tremendously collaborative. I think by the time work began on this process in 2003, everyone recognized that the system we had been working under was a failed system, and catch shares was what was settled on as the way forward. Fishermen and environmental groups and regulators really worked together to work through some of the design issues that have allowed it to be as effective as it is.
And is this throughout the West Coast or just California or just certain regions? How many people have bought into or are using this catch shares program?
It includes the whole West Coast. It's a federally managed fishery, so it's Washington, Oregon, California. And I think there's 150 permits out there, but there's only about 100 active trawlers actually working right now.
And Rob, tell me how the Catch Shares program has impacted you and your colleagues as fishermen.
When we were under the bi-monthly catch limits, we might not have been racing against other fishermen, but I was racing against the calendar. You know, I had to catch as much of my fish as I could before the 2 months period was up. Now I have a chunk of fish that I can catch them whenever I want, however I want. So if the market doesn't necessarily want that species of fish right now, I can save them until the market's better for them. I'm not so volume-oriented, so I'm trying to focus on quality. A portion of the fish I bring in alive. They pay top dollar for fish that I can get to the dock still being alive. And the way this program has worked for me, I'm considered a new entrant, even though I've been participating in it for 22 years, because I have no ownership in the fishery. When the quota was allocated, it was allocated to permit holders. And something that's happened with this fishery is there's a lot of non-owners that actually run the boat. So I didn't get an allocation. So every pound that I catch, I need to lease. So focusing on, you know, trying to get top dollar for my fish really makes sense, because I have to pay for every pound that I go catch. So the way I do it, I focus on quality. I try to catch less fish, but take better care of them. And we're still working. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of potential.
Tell me a little bit about your business. What kind of fish are you catching?
The ones I bring in alive are called thorny heads.
And how do you catch them?
With a trawl net. Some of the other species I catch are Dover sole, Petrolli sole, different species of rockfish. To fit into the community as best I could, I don't target black cod, or I target all the stuff that nobody else in town catches. Mm-hmm. And I think it works pretty good in the community.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell. And my guests are Rob Seitz, who's a lifelong fisherman who's working out of Morro Bay, and also Shems Judd, who is the Pacific Deputy Regional Director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Oceans Program. We're talking about the West Coast Catch Shares Program. Shems, would you tell me a little bit about the before and the now of catch shares? What did it look like before, and what does the fishery look like now?
Well, let me start way back in maybe the mid-90s or late 90s. We had quite a few more boats fishing than we have today. As I mentioned, there were trip limits in the fishery that were causing pretty significant regulatory discard and waste of perfectly good seafood. And then we also had the Pacific Fishery Management Council generating some new science that suggested that some of the slow-growing rockfish species were reaching critically low levels. And so that caused limits to be reduced dramatically. And in 2001, the fishery was actually declared an economic disaster. I think it I know you were fishing then, Rob, and I imagine it wasn't a fun time to be working.
No, that was pretty much the bottom, I think. We started not just poundage limits, but also they started limiting the areas that we were allowed to fish. Up until then, you know, you go out and anywhere in the ocean was open to us. But then they started this rock cod conservation area, which they made it off limits for us to fish in the depths that the rock cod primarily were in. So we were having to fish out in the deep water, which in the summertime, there's not much fish out there. Luckily, I was fishing out of the Columbia River, and there's lots of other fisheries I could participate in. So I focused on shrimping or crabbing, other fisheries.
Right. And I think under the management that we had, that was a very rational management action by the Pacific Fishery Management Council to close those big areas. I mean, there weren't tools in place that could limit the mortality of the sensitive stocks any other way. But then the catch share program comes in, and now each individual fisherman has complete accountability. There's a federal observer on the back deck of every boat on every trip. So every fish that's coming out of the water is counted down to the pound. We know exactly how much is coming out, and we can prove that the trawl fishermen participating in this program are adhering to the limits and are really fishing in a way that's much more sustainable than they were before, and maybe under the best regulations in the country. It's a pretty exceptional innovation.
Is there resistance to having somebody looking over your shoulder as you're fishing?
A bit. In smaller boats, you know, one extra person takes up more space. One more person you have to get along with. So I think that's the resistance. We've had observers since 2002, I believe, but they only were on the boat for 30% of the time. So now I have the ability to prove how clean I'm fishing, and I like that.
When you first heard about the Catch Shares program, what did you think of it? And did that change?
Being in Astoria for 20 years, a lot of guys fish up in Alaska, you know, that are from Astoria. So in 98 or 96, halibut and black cod up in Alaska went to an IFQ system, individual fish quota. It only took a couple of years, and the price per pound started climbing on halibut and black cod. And you can tell which fishermen are making the most money because they're the ones driving the brand new pickup trucks, you know. And all the guys driving new pickup trucks were in catch shares programs, you know. That influenced the way I saw it, I guess. And so when I heard that it was potential for us to get a catch shares plan, then I was all for it. Since then, BC Trawl Fishery, British Columbia in Canada, went catch share, and those guys are doing well up there. I met Shems, you know, before the IFQ was implemented. EDF did a really good job at finding people who participate in these catch shares to explain to us what to expect, what we're going to see happen. And so I feel like I was better prepared to make good decisions about how I'm going to go into this new management scheme.
Shems, how do fishermen and environmental organizations like yours work together?
I think it's, in a lot of ways, a relatively new development. You know, for years and years, it was a really pretty contentious relationship, I think, in most fields, in forestry and fishing, you name it. And in a lot of ways, the opportunity was ripe for a new kind of interaction. We knew that we needed to work through the management system in order to get this kind of change through. And, you know, the fishermen, I think, were really thinking along the same lines. They needed to do something differently as well. And so in some ways, it was just a happy coincidence of events that really allowed for this opportunity. I think I mentioned before, one of the benefits of catch shares is that it really realigns the economic incentive so that it's in fishermen's best interest to avoid those most sensitive stocks for which they have low quotas. And I think that's what brought the fishermen on board with the catch shares tool, that they may be able to be more profitable by fishing cleanly, and that's certainly in line with what we believe in and what we do.
So it's really kind of a happy story from all the different directions.
Yeah, and I mean, traditionally, environmentalists and draggers did not get along well at all. Shems is the first environmentalist I've ever I met. It's kind of funny because it seemed like when everything was getting worse and worse, we started seeing all these new limits and cut off areas that we weren't allowed to go anymore. And it was always viewed as somebody far away taking stuff away from us. And I think as this program started being implemented, a lot more people like Shem started coming to our communities. And so we had the opportunity to meet them, you know. But it seemed like things had to really hit a bottom before everyone became willing to work together. And then I think it was really helpful for me to actually get to know Shems, because I believe for all fisheries to be managed well, everybody needs to be able to work together with a relationship of trust. And so I think it's important to have a conservation representative in fishing communities so that people can get to know them. I think it's not so hard. It's not like somebody far away that you don't know taking stuff away from you.
It's Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking to Rob Seitz, who's a lifelong fisherman. He works out of Morro Bay. And also with me is Shems Judd of the Environmental Defense Fund's Oceans Program. Do you see things changing as a result of the program other than what you've already mentioned?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really exciting things happening. I mentioned the bycatch issue, the reduction in waste that we're seeing. I think as a result of the realigned incentives, we're also seeing dramatic reductions in catch of overfished species. So there's these rockfish species that are at very low levels of abundance. And the trawl fishermen now are catching only a fraction of their overall limits. And, I think that's an encouraging sign. I will say we're really only at the beginning of the story. This program was implemented in 2012, so we're about 2.5 years in. And while we're seeing these really encouraging conservation gains, there's a lot of work still to do. One of the biggest things that I'm focusing a lot of energy on now is making sure that guys like Rob can stay profitable, because I think the conservation gains that we're seeing won't be lasting and durable if the program's not working for them. And so we're really expending a lot of effort on trying to reduce some of the costs of the program, to increase opportunity where it can be done sustainably and in line with good conservation practices. And then also, because this is such sustainable, delicious local product, if we can help generate some market benefit for these fishermen that are really, they've been getting the same price for their fish for 30 years, and it doesn't make any sense.
What about, we hear about warming of the oceans and acidification of the oceans, and how does that play in to a program like this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, there's just beginning to be some serious scientific inquiry into those questions, at least with regard to rockfish. A lot of these are very deep water species. It's not entirely clear exactly whether or how ocean acidification will impact these species. Likewise, increases in ocean temperature may cause changes, but I'm not aware of any concrete information about exactly what's going to occur there, just that we're likely to see some changes.
I can say the live fish fishery that I've been doing has reduced my fuel consumption. And the way I understand it, that's the carbon emissions is what's causing this ocean acidification. But it seems like we're able to plan our trips better. I'm in my second year of fishing around here. I'm starting to learn the grounds a little better, but the fuel is incredibly high down here, really expensive. So that has a big effect on how I choose to fish. And that live fish, I end up making shorter tows, and we're spending more time dealing with the fish on deck, so less time of towing and burning fuel. I think that's one of the benefits of this catch share. I catch my fish slower, lower quantity, higher dollar amount, and burn less fuel.
With a regulator on board each vessel, sounds like that's probably pretty expensive. How is that funded, and what are some of the other costs that go into the catch shares program?
So right now, the observer is partially funded by the federal government. The initial plan was that there would be about a three-year subsidy. So in the initial year of the program, the federal government would pick up about 80 or 90% of the cost of the observer. I think it was supposed to decrease to about 50% in the second year and then 25% in the third year. The at-sea day cost for an observer is about $450 a day. And I think right now you're paying about 50% of that.
Yeah, it's about $200 a day.
So it's absolutely it is a serious cost. So we are exploring ways to bring down the cost of monitoring. For example, right now there's an effort underway with the Pacific Fishery Management Council to analyze electronic monitoring, whether or not cameras could serve the same essential function. There's a couple other costs as well. In 2003, there was a federally funded buyback loan that actually purchased, so it removed about 90 boats and permits from the fishery. And the concept there was basically to reduce the number of people able to catch and access the available fish. We had a problem where there are really too many boats chasing too few fish. And so the purpose of the loan was to remove some of that effort so that the remaining fishermen could be more successful while still adhering to the limits. But that loan, which was a federally funded loan at a relatively high interest rate, is currently being paid back by the remaining fishermen in the fishery. So each fisherman pays a 5% fee on all their fish, essentially to pay back this loan. And so there's an effort underway right now to refinance that loan at a lower interest rate and a longer term, with the intent still that the fishermen will pay it back, but at more favorable terms, so that that 5% fee could be reduced to 2 or 3%, which when you're already dealing with observer coverage and high fuel costs and the like, that 2 or 3% could make a big difference.
Yeah, big difference.
Well, it seems like it's a good story from all sides, and I'm wondering if you have hope for the future of fishing on the West Coast.
You have to have hope. And it looks more hopeful now to me than it did before catch shears.
Yeah, I'm actually really hopeful. You know, I think we've just been talking about some of the challenges in the fishery. But I think just seeing what fishermen have been able to do in the first 2.5 years of this program is really heartening. You know, before this program, no one was doing live fish in a trawl net, for example. And as Rob talked about, reducing his carbon footprint and reducing bycatch, reducing catch of overfished species, there's a lot of really exciting things going on. And so I think one of the most important things is to get that message out, get consumers excited about buying this great product that's now sustainable. This isn't the trawl fishing of 30 years ago. It's really a revolutionized fishery. And if we can make sure that guys like Rob are profitable and successful, I think this is going to be a great story.
If someone wants to find out more about the West Coast Catch Shares program, how does one do that?
There's a lot of great resources out there. There's been some really good information put together on the Pacific Fishery Management Council website. There's also an oceans page that EDF has that describes some of the benefits of the Catch Share system. And then there's, in line with this marketing discussion that we were just talking about, there's 100% monitored, no overfishing guarantee label that we've been developing in conjunction with some of the processors and fishermen. There's a website for that as well, and you can get a lot of background on the system.
Okay, and if someone wants to know more about how to get your fish, how do they find your fish?
I'm a member of a marketing co-op, Central California Seafood Marketing Association, and we have a website. You can either type in those words or wildcaliforniaseafood.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you both very much, Shems Judd of the Environmental Defense Fund, and also to fisherman Rob Seitz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Support for KCBX is provided by the 29th Central Coast Writers Conference at Cuesta College, September 20th and 21st, featuring the keynote address by Rebecca Rasmussen, titled Why We Write. Details are at communityprograms.net. Still ahead on Issues and Ideas, the California Surf Project is the fully illustrated travel diary of two surfers who took the trip of a lifetime. Join San Luis Obispo County Library Director Brian Reynolds as he chats with the book's author, Eric Soderquist, and photographer, Chris Picard. But first, Donna Cheek profiles two North San Luis Obispo County groups that improve the lives of cats and dogs.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas. Today, my guests are Rachel Summers, owner of Cause for Paws Thrift Shop, and Kathy Inns, founder of North County Paws Cause. Thank you both for joining me today.
Nice to be here.
Wonderful.
Let's start with you, Rachel. Why is it called Cause for Paws? What does that mean?
That we are a cause for helping animals.
And what is it that you do for the animals that you help?
We raise money that we donate to different nonprofits who are involved in offering spay and neuter services for animals in the North County.
Are these just cats and dogs or...
So far, we've done just cats. Okay. Next month, I'm hoping to do dogs.
And where did this idea come from?
I've always wanted to help animals, and I just didn't quite know how to put it together. When it did come together, it came together very, very quickly. I made the decision to open Cause for Paws the first week of February. Within 8 weeks of that, I was signing the lease on the new place. It all came together very, very quickly.
How does it work with regards to the proceeds?
The first thing we do, basically after we pay our overhead, half of that money goes to the spay-neuter program.
Awesome. So this has been open a little over a month.
That's correct, yes.
And how are things going?
They're going fantastic. The support from the community has just been incredible. Our donations, the beautiful things people donate, the generous way that people come in and shop with us, it's just inspiring. I love it.
You're right, because I do remember going to the reception that you invited me to, and that was very nice, and I must say that I was surprised by the quality of your merchandise.
My vision for the shop was that when you walk in the door, it's like being in an upscale boutique. It doesn't have the feel or the look or the smell of a thrift shop. Your first indication that you are indeed in a thrift shop is when you look at a price tag. And we have been blessed with so many donations that we can choose to have very, very high quality items at very low prices.
That's great.
Our first check went to Kathy Enns at Paws Cause for the project they're doing where they're spaying and neutering feral cats from Atascadero Creek.
That's wonderful. And you mentioned Kathy, and Kathy, I'm so glad that you're here. I want to talk with you about Paws Cause. You know, these names here, it's kind of similar, but well, it makes sense.
It's funny in a way because it was actually a happy accident in that Rachel chose the name of her store without knowing anything about us. And I kept hearing from my volunteers and people who would reach out to me for help, hey, what about your thrift store in Atascadero? And I said, well, I don't have a thrift store. And finally, I found her phone number and called her up and said, hey, what are you doing? This is my name. It's confusing people. And she said, oh, my goodness, I didn't know. I'm so sorry. I've already ordered the signage. And I said, well, we'll live with it. We got to talking and realized that our missions are so very aligned.
Yes.
That it was actually turned out to be serendipitous, because even though it is a little confusing, now we are partnering very much so, and hope to partner going forward in the cause that we both share.
Yes. What is it that your organization does?
So North County Paws Cause, which is our official name, we've been around for just under 3 years now, and our mission is to improve the lives of North County cats. What we mainly focus on is spay and neuter. In doing a little research about where we could do the most good when we opened up, we came to find out that 70% of the cats that go down to the county shelter come from North County. So we're only a third or so of the county in size, but we were supplying 70% of the unwanted cats. And I thought, okay, what's the best way to reverse that trend? It's spay and neuter. You shut off the problem at the supply. So we've been spaying and neutering our hearts out for about 2.5 years, and we've handled roughly 1,300 cats. So we're working as fast as we can, but as you can imagine, our constant challenge is funding, which is where Rachel comes in and where we were so happy to make her acquaintance.
Now, Now, why is it there are so many cats coming from North County as compared to any other part of the
county? Well, there are a number of reasons. One I can point to is that we tend to be fairly rural up in North County, and it's just unfortunately not the tradition of many ranchers to spay and neuter. Ranchers keep cats for mousing and so forth, and many nowadays have become more enlightened and will spay and neuter. Many still don't. Up in North County, we also have areas of our territory that are fairly low-income communities where people just can't afford it. Those are the main reasons that I can point to. We've had a lot of economic impact from the troubles that we've been through as a country up in North County, lots of foreclosures, and that, you know, leads to abandoned cats, unfortunately. So you put all those three things together, and it's just become a kind of a perfect storm of kittens and their kittens and their kittens.
How often does a cat come into heat?
Well, a full-grown veteran mom cat will produce at least 2 litters a year, sometimes 3, occasionally 4. The really sad thing to me, one of the saddest things that I think we face, is that females as young as 6 months old can get pregnant. So they're unfortunately the teen moms of our community.
Oh, no.
And those cats really struggle. It's just heartbreaking to see it go on. So you can see kind of the exponential effect of all this. In fact, it's common knowledge that a breeding pair of cats and their kittens, so the exponential effect can be as high as 400,000 cats in the first pair's lifetime.
Wow.
So it's easy to see how a situation can rapidly get out of hand.
How did you get into this?
Well, for my professional career years ago, I worked in business. And then I'm also an animal lover like you. And when I was a busy professional raising children and so forth, what I could do was give money. But always in the back of my mind, I wanted to do more. So I went to a couple of conferences and learned from some of the big players, if you will, in the animal welfare world. And the more I thought about it, and the more I thought, you know, putting together what I care about, which is animal welfare, with what I know, which is business, I maybe could do something more. So I wanted to try, and I started out very slowly, because one thing I think an animal person may not know as they get into this world is what they can bear. To me, it was a big unknown. Can I really do this without breaking the bank and breaking my heart?
Yes.
And so I started little by little, and the more I did it and the more I found like-minded people, the more I thought, oh, I can do this. And the key, Donna, I have a very tolerant husband.
Oh.
That's really
the key. It sounds like he's not only tolerant, but very supportive,
He too. Is. He does the books, and he will jump in and go to a rescue if I'm not available. So he does support me in everything I do, and I'm very lucky.
And the books are important because you're nonprofit.
Yes, we are a 501c3. So as you know, there are lots of things that you have to do to keep your status, and he does all of that for me.
What are the different scenarios that you encounter?
Well, that's a great question. I love that question. We get lots of calls, and they range greatly in terms of what people are asking for. So spay and neuter is our mission. But knowing the lack of resources available in North County, we try never to say just absolute no. So the easiest call I had was a gal who said she had had a stray turn up at her house, and she was willing to give him a home. Hooray. But she wanted help in getting him tested for a couple of prevalent kitty diseases. And so I happened to have some test kits and a friend who's a vet tech. And I put the two together, and the cat got tested. He was negative. She kept him. We're good. So
Perfect.
That was the easiest one. The hardest one was I had a call from a woman who lives in Paso Robles and has 35 cats and can't deal with it anymore. Most of them are sick, and none of them are altered. So she called for help. And that's kind of the hardest situation we have. She said, you know, I looked on your website and saw some of your stories of hoarders, and I'm one of those people. And I thought, well, it's a start. I mean, she's self-aware. She knows she's got a problem, and we'll just have to work on it till it's under control. We don't have a facility, so we rescue and place kittens into foster care.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas. We are talking with Rachel Summers and Kathy Winds about their efforts to curb pet overpopulation in North County through spay and neuter. What I like is you offer assistance in an area that is so far away from woods. That's a trek from Paso to woods, and it sounds to me you fill in a critical need.
Well, Donna, to connect with what you're saying, we actually do work with woods quite a bit. We work on the fringes of their spay and forward program because sometimes people from Atascadero and Paso can't get down there. So every once in a while, we'll take a load of cats down and try to include some spay and forward cats. Woods also has created a program to help North County Paws Cause with a little bit lower cost than the public can access, and they call it Project Meow. So we do leverage, if you will, Woods' assistance just as often as we can because that helps lower costs for us. But one thing we do need help with because we do all this is transportation. If people don't want to trap and they don't have a lot of money but they have a good big vehicle, I can use drivers to help us go to Slow and Back. I'm always looking for people who want to learn how to trap, help a feral cat retire from the kitten-producing business. Of course, I'm seeking donations constantly to keep all these balls in the air. I like it when people give me big bags of cat food because we feed groups of cats around town that we've spayed and neutered and we're keeping our eye on, but they're not really adoptable. They're feral or they're happy where they are and they're welcome where they are, but they just need food support. We do that too. So just about anything that somebody wants to do that will help an animal, help a cat, we can put them to work.
Wonderful.
Oh, one thing too, yes. Let me not forget, is fosters. We need fosters like crazy, especially now when it's kitten season.
Okay, fosters mm-hmm. for kittens.
That's right.
See, that should be something that would be very enjoyable.
Well, kittens are the best. I mean, it's almost free fun to foster kittens. Of course,
yes.
You have to feed them and all that.
Yes.
But
yes.
And it is hard when you give them up. It's hard. And we have our share of failed fosters, meaning fosters who couldn't give them up. But sometimes people do both. They'll keep their very favorite that they can't possibly part with, and then they'll foster another litter and another.
I remember reading somewhere online that it's just strictly volunteers.
Right. We have no paid staff, no sanctuary, no shelter.
That maximizes the resources going directly to the cats and the kittens.
That's absolutely right. And I happen to know that that's one thing that's important to Rachel, too, is when she looks for people to fund through her thrift shop efforts. One thing she doesn't want to pay, and this is true of many donors, is they don't really want to pay overhead costs. They want their money to go right to the heart of the matter, which in our case is spay and neuter. And that's why I was so fortunate that Rachel chose us to be the recipients of her first month's worth of proceeds.
Really?
Isn't that nice?
That's fabulous. And how did that go?
She was making a lot of money for Paws Cause.
Yes.
I heard this through Atascadero Citizens, but I waited to hear. I wanted to be surprised, and she called me one day and said, guess what? It's $2,771.51.
That's amazing. Rachel, congratulations.
It was one of the highest moments of my life, getting to write that check and to give it away.
That is so incredible. And we need to keep that enthusiasm and that momentum going. Do you realize how many Americans have storage units? Clean out the storage units and take all your stuff to the thrift shop.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. I would like to say something about fostering. You can change a life forever by fostering. It's such an important thing to do. I really encourage people, if you think you might want a cat, but you're not sure, fostering is the perfect way to find out because you'll have the cat and you know it's going somewhere good when it leaves you. And if you don't want it to leave, well, that's okay too. But at least it gives you a chance to try on having that presence in your life.
I see that as being a great idea. If you have children, fostering is the perfect way to test out the commitment your child has.
And your own personal commitment too.
That's true.
One thing that my organization, Cause for Paws Thrift Shop, is really in need of volunteers, of people to help in our shop. shop. It's a wonderful way for people who love animals to volunteer because there are no animals to fall in love with at my shop. So you won't be bringing any little new pets home with you, but you will be helping animals, and we would love to see more people come out and volunteer. And I just wanted to ask anyone in the community that would like to come forward.
Perfect. Thank you, Kathy and Rachel, for coming in to talk with me today. I hope the listeners will want to help by adoption, fostering, volunteering, or giving a generous donation. I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas.
This is Public Radio KCBX. Support for KCBX is provided in part by attorney Lisa C. Gillinger, helping people who cannot work because of injury or illness obtain their Social Security benefits. More information is at 568-5370. Social Security Disability, it's all they do. Support also comes from Slow Natural Foods, formerly the Natural Foods Co-op. A new name, new place, and more space. It's still the same local service and sustainably produced food. More information can be found at slonaturalfoods.com. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. Today's episode features a rare conversation with philosopher and Catholic social innovator Jean Vanier. Considered by some to be a living saint, he created La Arche, or The Ark. It's a community centered around people with mental disabilities that has become a global movement spanning 40 countries. That's On Being at 2 o'clock here on KCBX. Now, we join San Luis Obispo County Library Director Brian Reynolds for a chat with the author and photographer of the book, The California Surf Project.
This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Joining me today are local authors Eric Soderquist and photographer Chris Burkhart. We're going to be discussing The California Surf Project, an incredibly beautiful book and experience of photographing and surfing up and down the California coast from Oregon to the Mexican border. Welcome.
Great to be here, Brian. Thanks again, man.
Thanks. This is going to be an exciting topic, and I'm sure something that is of prime interest to our listeners on the Central Coast. Eric, could you tell me more or less how the project got started?
I would have to say just from being a total beach bum and wanting to be at the beach every single day of my life, and then also bumping into my friend Chris here, and we both had the same idea about what was going on, and so we started carpooling and just basically traveling the coast of California together, capturing images that we loved and being in spots that inspired us.
Now, you're both from the area, is that correct?
Yeah, born and raised.
How did you meet?
Like Eric said, we met at the beach. You know, I think it's funny because the book is sort of a collection of everything that we had already been doing. We'd already been traveling together and surfing and photographing or painting, but it was just this idea of, you know, being able to meet someone who kind of has similar interests and sees things the same way as you. Eric's an incredible artist, and, you know, me being able to have photography to express myself, we were both looking at things the same way, and so we met each other at the beach. Pismo Pier was kind of the meeting place, it seemed like, for a lot of occasions, and then we would carpool from there and go surf up the coast or down south or wherever.
Somebody told me once that this Central Coast is sort of a spiritual place. You know, the Native Americans used it as a way to communicate with the great spirits, like Point Sal being one of those places. And I certainly can believe in the magic, having been blessed to live here for 20 years. Eric, what made you think that this would be a viable project in terms of getting a book published?
You know, I never even thought about that, actually. I think I just wanted to make the book and maybe give it to my grandparents or something and be like, that's awesome. But
did you approach publishers or get an agent or...
Yeah, I mean, Chris had a friend, and he had also another friend that surfed and worked for Chronicle Books. So it was as casual as that. I mean, we basically went surfing in San Francisco one day, and the girl we were with, I was like, okay, so how are you going to get us in with this whole publishing thing, you know, to get us in the door? And she's like, oh, I am the publisher.
Wow. So that was pure serendipity?
Yeah, it was just easy.
Serendipity and a mix of, you know, just them really loving the idea behind the project. You know, we shot this whole book basically on our own dime. And the concept, you know, we thought about, we toiled over a lot and, like, you know, how to do it, how to frame it, because we wanted it to be something that was relevant, first of all, and timeless. And that's exactly what it was, and it still is. You know, that's why we are able to still, you know, talk about it and sell a lot of copies. And I was working for Surfline, which is a big... surfing website at the time, and the editor was a good friend of both of ours, and we were up in the city surfing with him, and we had finished the project, had all the photos, and we presented it to him. We're like, you know, do you think there's a chance we could, you know, meet with Chronicle? And we, like I said, we had met the gal who runs all the surf publications there, and she saw it and she's like, it's a little rough, but we love it and we want to make it work, you know. So obviously that process started, you know, glacial scale of printing and publishing a book, and we learned a lot and changed some things, and it was awesome.
Since I'm a librarian, I know that there's a lot of people, maybe everybody has a book inside of them or multiple books, but to actually get those out on paper and have it created by a publisher that has to put up the money for the printing and the distribution and all that is pretty huge. Maybe, you know, one author, a budding author in 100 gets that to happen. So that's amazing. So was your intent to promote surfing or promote the whole ocean and beach experience and the ecology of it, or was it all of the above?
I think it was simpler than that. You know, I think that, like, you know, you talked about living in this area and living near Big Sur, and we wanted to be able to have something that spoke to anyone who had honeymooned down the coast or kayaked or hiked, or it had nothing to do with surfing, really. And really, the majority of images in the book are very un-ocean related. It's about creating an experience for people to want to get outside their front door and go explore, you know, go explore this amazing coastline we have because it's so diverse. And Eric and me have traveled most of our lives, you know, to Iceland and Russia and Indonesia and all over the world for either work or surf or whatever. And our favorite place is California. So we wanted to create something that really was a testament to that experience.
We were talking earlier before recording about the magic of living near the coast, which very few people get to do. Maybe a lot of people want to do it. But also there's this stereotype of California where, having lived in the Midwest and traveled a little bit, you know, people were surprised that I wasn't blonde and knew how to surf, you know, because that's the icon, that's the stereotype that California has. And it's done through movies and different things. But in a way, you guys epitomize that, and I'm sure in the very best ways. And I would also comment that your artistic backgrounds between not just enjoying surfing, which is a physical sport, but painting and photography, I'm sure helped to make the book a real smash in that way.
Absolutely. It was a you know, very conscious decision to shoot the book in a way that, you know, me and Erica discussed this in a way that would, like I said, you couldn't identify it being 1960 or 2000, you know, 9, 2010 when we shot it. So we wanted the images to be, you know, really classic silhouettes or images that were timeless and just had that aesthetic to kind of, you know, inspire anyone who maybe picked it up from now or, you know, 5 years ago.
There was also a lot of historical signs in the book that are gone now, you know.
Right.
Like, you're, even if it's an old market or something, you see that every day is like, even as a kid or something, that's inspiring because it reminds you of that place.
Right.
And that kind of...
Or old windmills. Or old little... We would be looking for that in era. It's cool. It's funny how you said it a second ago that, you know, it's like some days we would be driving through these golden hills and we wouldn't even get to the beach. Like, we'd get so obsessed by, like, some little snake we found on the side of the road. And like, oh, let's go catch that thing and photograph it. Or let's wait for the sunset here in, you know, in the Sonoma Coast before we get to the beach. And we'd obsess over those things. And Eric had all these awesome reference paintings that we would go and, like, kind of seek out to shoot. And it was just fun. It was like adventure in its purest form. You know, we had no agenda. It wasn't sponsored or endorsed by any brands. And that was really what we wanted to portray.
Wow, that's not the American dream.
Exactly.
We'll let that go. Another aspect of the coast, California coast, we're talking about is it can be a harsh environment. I remember reading an account of Lewis and Clark, who were wound up on the mouth of the Columbia, I think, back in the early 1800s. And they had a miserable winter. They didn't know how to catch fish. They couldn't get a fire started. Even then, 200 years ago, it was a demanding environment. Did you find that at all in your travels?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the rain was definitely getting to us and just the dampness. And it really was coming down to, like, the simplicity of, like, even being able to get a hot tea was like a thrill, like, yes, something warm, you know, like,
or dry socks.
Yeah, or dry socks. Or,
oh gosh, I mean, the stories that we have from the road are, you know, we could do a whole, you know, 5-hour show just on some of the funny stories. But I mean, me and Eric spent Thanksgiving with a bum at some campground because everywhere was closed and we were in Mendocino and it was like $50, like, you know, set course meals and everywhere. And we were like, we're just gonna have a cup of noodles down here. It was like, you know, -4 degrees out. It was so cold that day. But the funniest thing is, like you said, the rain is really, you know, it's brutal. I remember I was up top because we had a Vanagon, you know, pop top, and I had the upper deck. And for the first like 2 weeks, it basically rained on and off. And I remember we get to Mendocino. It was like one of the first sunny, cloudless days. And I'm like, we're so excited. The pop top's up. The wetsuits are hanging out. Everything's drying out. And we're like, yes, finally going to dry out and, you know, be able to put on like dry socks. So we get back to the car after being down at the beach. It's all warm. Close it and close the top. And then later on that night, we're going to set up camp. And I pop the top up and it just – all I hear is snap, snap, snap. And the whole thing had shrunk. And so it just – I basically had a sunroof now. It was awesome. So it was just little funny anecdotes from the road. You know, you realize like you're pretty in tune with the weather when you're out in it every day.
Are some of those anecdotes in the book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's little you know, stories and little bits and pieces. You know, Eric did such an awesome job writing the thing, just kind of explaining like what it was like. We spent every day in the bus for 50 days, you know, and you know, by today's standards, it's like I would almost love to be able to go out and do it again, you know, because we're always so busy. It's like it was a dream trip. So.
Yeah, you take those opportunities, they don't come again.
No.
This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Joining me today are local author Eric Soderquist and photographer Chris Burkhardt, and we're discussing their amazing book. It's The California Surf Project. Tell me about the changing conditions, starting in Northern California, which would be Del Norte County. How did it start, and how did you sort of see the beach or the surfing change as you went south?
When we first started up at the border, it's all like berry lined. You can just pick blackberries on the side of the road, and it's much more rugged, less signs of like don't do this or don't do that. It's pretty much you could be your own man if you want and go wander out through the beach, and definitely more rugged. The ocean's more wide open. There's a lot more rocks and it kind of looks like Cambria-esque.
You know, as you move down the coast, you just start to see more bays and little places where the swell can wrap in and clean up. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but there's actually a DVD in the book.
Oh, not yet. Yeah, I look forward to it.
You got to watch it. It's cool. And it kind of has a bunch of surf footage and little clips we shot along the road. And that was one of the most unique things about it is actually Chronicle hadn't done that before. And so we proposed that idea. And so there's a little slipcase DVD in the very back end of the book. And it gives people kind of an insight visually, you know.
Yeah, and another way to tell your story.
Yeah, and Eric shot all the footage for that, and I helped a little bit. And it was, we had a great editor. It was super awesome to be able to, you know, kind of put, you know, visual image, you know, moving pictures along with the actual book. So,
you know, the California coastline is quite different, just like the Oregon coastline is different. But it seems to me that it's relatively flat. That is, the land and the sea are more or less on the same elevation until you get to Big Sur and maybe around Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. Did you find it that way, or was the landscape quite a bit different, let's say, looking at it from the ocean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to be looking in from the ocean, and when you're in a bay that's, like, tree-lined and there's cliffs and you're looking up these, like, mysterious mountains, it's such a raw, rugged feeling, especially if you're by yourself, and then you start looking around seals, and you very much feel alive in a small, just piece, little speck in what's going on.
You never saw any sharks, I hope.
There's a couple spots we surfed. One of them, right outside of Monterey, had a shark attack 2 weeks after we were there.
Wow.
And we were there on an epic, you know, offshore, beautiful day. And it, you know, you wouldn't have even thought in, you know, ever, like, oh, this is a sharky spot. It looked beautiful and perfect. And literally 2 weeks later, there was a shark attack there. And then at one point, the very first surf we ever had, Eric surfed in the mouth of the Smith River. We saw an awesome standing wave that was just coming in from outside, like big, you know, raw ocean swell, and then coming in. And then the river would meet it, and it would make a little kind of double up still wave right there. So Eric runs up the river and paddles across, and the current barely makes it to the other side, almost gets sucked out to sea, which would have been like imminent death or something. And he's surfing, and then a local guy comes up to me, like some like Indian guy, and just like, oh man, that's so dangerous. There's a guy that got attacked by a shark here not too long ago. And I'm like, I can't wave him down, you know, but he was a champ. He surfed 90% of the time by himself on all these places, you know. And the one thing I think about California is I think it has the most diverse coastline, because you think about, you know, like Eric said, you're looking in from LA or San Diego, and it's like a desert down there. You know, you see power lines and this and that. And then you're up in, you know, Crescent City, and you're looking in, you see, you know, just pine trees and, you know, mist and sea fog, and it's just, it's so diverse. You know, I don't think you get that as much in Washington, Oregon, because it kind of stays the same, you know, sort of landscape throughout.
How much of the beach in California is urban versus rural, would you say?
Oh, that's tough, huh? I don't know. That's kind of a hard question. I mean, up north, even if you are at the beach, you're not looking in at a small town for the most part. Yeah. And then a lot of the spots, you know, like around here, if you're surfing a pier or something, you could even look in the quaint little towns like Cayucas and
Pismo. Yeah, it's
so the buildings, the human footprint, if you will, is not that apparent from the ocean.
Yeah, and that's what's great about it, and that's the freedom of being in the ocean, and that's why I feel blessed to grow up as a surfer my whole life, because you're able to have your own like journey without like a, you know, stoplight saying, okay, you can go now. It's like you do whatever you want. You're your own person out there. So
right, you in the ocean.
Like, yeah, it's the freedom. You're basically the freedom within the boundaries of what nature will let you do as a human.
This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Joining me today are author Eric Soderquist and photographer Chris Burkhardt, and we're discussing their amazing book, The California Surf Project. Gentlemen, what would you say is important for people to know about California's coast or how it's changing, how it's threatened? Let's get into the political and environmental realm a little bit.
With California, there's so many issues, obviously, but I guess your experience is only limited to kind of what you're experiencing firsthand. And I know for us, some of our favorite parks and state parks, national parks, whatever, are closed down or don't have access because they can't staff them and they can't fund them. And that's such a bummer, you know, to see. And I know that I think one thing, too, you know, you go to the farthest, most remote beach in the world, doesn't matter where you are, and there's plastic there.
And litter.
Yeah, litter everywhere. I mean, you could be in the most just pristine whatever, and you'll find that. So I think it's always important, you know, for us, it was cool to be able to live off the land and buy food locally where we were and actually, like, you know, we're not just like, you know, we'd get food from people we'd meet, or we would barter, we'd trade. It was a cool experience to kind of live like that, almost a little more like natives, you know?
Yeah, that was one thing. We never stopped and ate fast food on that whole trip or anything.
You know, I think the natural environment is kind of a conundrum, having enjoyed it all my life, that it's something that everybody would benefit by experiencing. And we're so lucky to have it close by. But on the other hand, you can also overuse it. I mean, overuse becomes abuse really quick. Too many people or careless people. One person throwing down a candy wrapper kind of wrecks it for the next person. So it's a very fragile environment. At the same time, it's very important.
Yeah.
Important too. Well, what would you say has changed about surfing or about people enjoying the coast over the last few years? Any significant differences from when you were younger?
Yeah, I would say equipment, really, because when I was a little kid around here, our wetsuits were so bad that they would literally, you'd be bleeding from rashes from the seams of them.
Wow.
And then your boards were generally logs, and you had one of them. Nowadays, you have 5 brand new wetsuits, 15 brand new surfboards, and it's looked at like a little sport for people, like almost a little league thing.
Yeah.
Back in the day, if you were at the beach and you just found a wetsuit, someone was like, oh, wow, crazy. It was like
gold.
You know,
you mean a good wetsuit?
Yeah. It's the equipment, I think. Yeah, you're right. It changes the way you experience the coast, and also, you know, I just think it's, you know, it from the photography perspective, you know, it's like I've been able to really dive into, like, you know, using water housings and using all that equipment and documenting it in different ways. So that's been exciting too, and seeing how it's changed and developed. You know, people always ask me, like, oh, you know, what'd you shoot this book with? What'd you shoot this trip? And it was just the most mediocre equipment, you know.
Really?
And I've never really been one to, you know, obviously now, you know, things have changed and stuff, and I've got a lot of different gear I'll shoot different projects with. But when I shot this, it was just such in the infancy of my career and in a lot of ways. And I like the idea of being a little closer to nature. And you know, the less, you know, objects and equipment you have between you and your subject, the more intimate it's going to be. So I think for us, like, this is a real intimate project and trip, and it was amazing to experience and to share.
I'm assuming, Chris, that your job was a lot harder because Eric could surf and you had to do all of that and take pictures, right?
Yeah. Well, I barely got to get in the water because I didn't want to miss a single thing.
Yeah. But, I don't know how they get lenses and good pictures with drops of seawater on the lens. I'd like to thank you both for being with me today. This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Joining me today have been local author Eric Soderquist and local photographer Chris Burkhardt talking about their amazing adventure of several years ago that became a wonderful book put out by Chronicle Books, and which, since I'm happy to say, the California Surf Project. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Support for KCBX is provided by Otter Productions, presenting a very special evening with John Hyatt and his combo at the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande, Saturday, September 7th. Tickets are available at the Clark Center box office at 489-9444. Support also comes from the Basin Street Regulars, the Central Coast Hot Jazz Society, presenting America's music at the Vets Hall in Pismo Beach. Complete information is at the Basin Street Regulars, for the Basin Street Regulars is at pismojazz.com. This is Public Radio KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. We are streaming live on the web at kcbx.org. Stay tuned next for On Being. The time is now 2 o'clock.